So let's open up in prayer and then we'll dive in. Gracious God, we ask for your blessing today on this lesson and on our lives. Help us to be witnesses to your love, your compassion and convictions, and help us to be true followers of you and just witnesses to your mercy and grace, Lord. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. Last time we were together, we were talking about Brueggemann's three disciplines of humanness. We've talked about that for the last couple of weeks: listening, discerning, and trusting. And we ended last time we were together talking about what does it mean to be humans in extreme situations, in crisis. What does that look like? And as it turns out, Brueggemann has a different set of disciplines for those kinds of situations we find ourselves in, when listening and discerning and trusting may not be possible or may seem inadequate. And Brueggemann is so honest about what it means to be a human being. His anthropology is so solid and so real. And so he pivots from what he calls the three disciplines of humanness to these other three disciplines of humans in extremis is the term that he uses. Humans in crisis. What does that look like? So what I want to do today is, in this lesson, is look at what Brueggemann says there. But first, what I'd like to do is read the salient passages from Exodus 13 and 14, where we had just, you know, the last time we read out of Exodus 2 weeks ago, we had been reading from 12 and 13, and literally that the part of Exodus that is considered the Exodus, the actual part where they leave Egypt. And now we're picking it up at verse 17 of chapter 13 and just reading into the first half of chapter 14. So here we are. They've just talked about the laws and restrictions surrounding the celebration of the Passover meal. And now we read about the Israelites about to cross the Red Sea. So here's where we pick it up in verse 17 of chapter 13. When Pharaoh let the people go, God did not lead them on the road through the Philistine country, though that was shorter. God said if they face war, they might change their minds and return to Egypt. So God led the people around by the desert and toward the Red Sea. The Israelites went up out of Egypt ready for battle. Moses took the bones of Joseph with him because Joseph had made the Israelites swear an oath. He had said, God will surely come to your aid, and then you must carry my bones up with you from this place. After leaving Sukkoth, they camped at Etham on the edge of the desert. By day, the Lord went ahead of them in a pillar of cloud to guide them on their way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light so that they could travel by day or night. Neither the pillar of cloud by day nor the pillar of fire by night left its place in front of the people. Then the Lord said to Moses, tell the Israelites to turn back and encamp near Pi Hachiroth between Migdol and the sea. They are to camp by the sea directly opposite Baal Zephon. Pharaoh will think the Israelites are wandering around the land in confusion, hemmed in by the desert. And I will harden Pharaoh's heart and he will pursue them. But I will gain glory for myself through the Pharaoh and all his army, and the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord. So the Israelites did this. When the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled, Pharaoh and his officials changed their minds about them and said, what have we done? We've let the Israelites go and have lost their services. So he had his chariot made ready and took his army with him. He took 600 of the best chariots along with all the other chariots of Egypt, with officers over all of them. The Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, so that he pursued the Israelites who were marching out boldly. The Egyptians, all Pharaoh's horses and chariots, horsemen and troops, pursued the Israelites and overtook them as they camped by the sea near Pi Hachiroth opposite Baal Zephon. As Pharaoh approached, the Israelites looked up, and there were the Egyptians marching after them. They were terrified and cried out to the Lord. They said to Moses, was it because there were no graves in Egypt that you brought us to the desert to die? What have you done to us by bringing us out of Egypt? Didn't we say to you in Egypt, leave us alone, let us serve the Egyptians? It would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the desert. But Moses answered the people, "Do not be afraid. Stand firm, and you will see the deliverance of the Lord that he brings to you today. The Egyptians you see today, you will never see again. The Lord will fight for you. You need only to be still." So this is the end of the reading from Exodus 13 and 14. So the Hebrews are in crisis, in immediate, intense, and overwhelming crisis. They assume they are all about to die, that just as they've been released from 400 years of bondage, you hear them complaining about it directly to Moses. They wish they were just back in Egypt, sort of assuming the status quo, even though it was not good for them there. The prospects of being killed out in the desert just seems overwhelming to them, even though it's based on a promise of God that they are being set free. Here they are on the brink of escape, of newfound freedom, and now suddenly their world comes crashing down and all hope seems lost. And in some ways, not much unlike what so many of us are feeling now and what much of the underprivileged world is experiencing and has been experiencing for a long time. We are living what Brueggemann calls a life in extremis, in extreme circumstances. Brueggemann says that when these times come, the first set of human disciplines, they're just inadequate. And we cannot necessarily count on them or lean on them. The three disciplines of humanness, listening, discerning, and trusting, are fine for most of the time we live. But there are times when those simply don't do. And so he talks about how this second set of disciplines allows us to right the trouble, to make it right again through times of confusion and suffering. And this second set of disciplines, there are three of them, are complaint, petition, and thanksgiving. So let's look at each one of them in turn here and see if we can't unpack some truth that would be pertinent to our situation today. So in complaint, Brueggemann says, we refuse to simply resign to our troubles. And rather than simply resigning, we voice our legitimate complaints to God, trusting that God isn't threatened by our complaints, but is instead moved by them. So you see this in the Psalms, in Job, in the prophets. And, you know, at first blush, you look at this discipline and you think, the discipline of complaint? I mean, it strikes us as odd. One of our disciplines of humanness is to complain to God. This is how Brueggemann puts it. Quote, "The complaint is sometimes focused directly on Yahweh, who has been absent, silent, indifferent, even neglectful, and who is therefore indirectly responsible for the present plight of the speaker. What is important about this feature of humanness is that Israel understands that the human agent has rights, and that these rights require voiced protest and insistence. Thus, the person shuns every temptation of docile, deferential silence. Israel," and note the name Israel, one who contends with God. "Israel is clear, moreover, that such angry and insistent protests addressed to Yahweh are not acts of unfaith, as they are often thought to be in quietistic Christian piety, but are a vigorous act of freedom and responsibility." And I might personally add myself, really a sign of faith. So that's what Brueggemann says about this first discipline of complaint. And I wanted to add that little note about the name Israel, which Brueggemann doesn't talk about in this particular passage that I read. But I wanted to add that in the quote just because it is so sort of salutary, I think, for us to remind ourselves that in being called Israel, and we are referred to as the new Israel, that that the very name itself implies a living faith that contends with God. If we aren't struggling at various points, I would even say on almost a regular basis in our faith, we probably, I hesitate to put it so starkly, but I'll say it the way I've said it to my college students. If you're not struggling in your faith on some level, then you probably don't believe. There are those moments for sure where we're not struggling directly and things seem to be fine. But I think those are the exceptions that prove the rule. The rule of faith really is, Lord, I believe, help my unbelief. I think that's just about what we can expect in life. And faith is by its very definition, something to contend with. God is someone to contend with. It doesn't come naturally for us unless we're 4, 5, 6, or 7 to simply believe. We've seen too much of life. We've seen too much tragedy. We've seen too many difficult things happen. And for us to simply just believe, it can morph into a real sense of sort of pietistic denial, you know? It can look like faith when really what it is active denial of the reality of life. And the kind of faith that we see in the heroes of the Old and New Testament are never a quietistic, sort of silent faith, rarely so. They're a contentious faith, a faith that struggles. And I love how Brueggemann honors that, and he understands this. He interprets the Old Testament as being a testimony to this contentious faith, to living up to our name, Israel, one who contends with God. As you remember, Jacob's name is changed when he wrestles with God by the springs of Mamre, that he is changed and he renames the place Bethel. For surely God was here and I didn't even know it. I didn't even sense it. And I think... I think it's important that we understand that the right to complain is also a responsibility to complain. I think if we simply see it as a right, then we'll get sloppy with it and we'll our complaints will be presumptuous. But I think if we understand our complaints as a responsibility, then I think we can complain in ways that are more honest and true and profitable, frankly. What we see on the streets of America and around the world are largely an example of this responsible form of complaining, of standing up against your oppressor, of wanting to be part of a revolution. Now, there are those who are presumptuous in their complaints, and they're the ones who loot from stores and burn and create chaos. They're the presumptuous complainers, but the responsible complainers are the ones who are marching peacefully and protesting. I mean, after all, we are, as Presbyterians, part of the Protestant tradition, right? We ought to be honoring these protests. We honor peaceful protests for people who have suffered, for people who are underprivileged, for people who are on the margins, for the least of these. We as a church, it's in our very tradition, the Protestant tradition, to honor peaceful protest. It's what this country was built on. There was a lovely article, I don't remember which one it was now, that talked about how this country was built on protest. That's how amendments were formed and created. That's how the Declaration of Independence is a document of protest, right? It's standing up. It's a declaration. And that's what the 99% of people who are marching in the streets are all about, is declaring their independence and declaring their call for justice and fairness and peace. And so there is a there, so complaint does become a responsibility. And again, as I noted earlier, we see this in the Psalms, we see it in Job, we see it in the prophets. Now, obviously, what Job, for example, teaches us is that at some point, however, you can't begin and end at complaining. And this is what I like about Brueggemann's whole second set of disciplines of humanness, is that it only begins in complaint. It doesn't end there. That's a really, really important caveat to point out, that if it were simply about complaining, then the book of Job would have ended very differently. But finally, God has had enough, and he just literally shuts Job down and says, "Where were you when I laid the foundation for the universe and the stars and laid them out in the sky? Where were you?" You know, and it reminds me of the end of, towards the end of Till We Have Faces, C.S. Lewis's novel, which I know I've talked about in this class before, where Orwell, who is the protagonist in the story, continues to argue and complain and argue before the priests. And finally they say, "Silence. Have you been answered?" they say. And isn't that interesting that the priests ask Orwell if she has been answered when there was no answer provided? But it's almost as if the echo of her complaint was the answer. And she realizes this herself. She says, "If they hadn't silenced me, I would have gone on complaining for all of eternity. And I realized in their silence was my answer. They had heard my complaint. They were patient to listen. But life can't end there." And this is effectively what Brueggemann is saying, is that we are called to complain. There is a responsibility for us to complain, because otherwise, how can we have a legitimate relationship with the living God if all we are is this sort of blind acquiescence? You know, we it's sort of treacle. We're just being super ultra sweet and mindlessly deferential to God. That's not a relationship. That's just complete and total subservience. But that's not what God is interested in. God is in a relationship with us. The living God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is not Allah. Allah merely wants to be served and obeyed. God wants to be loved. And in order to love someone, you have to be honest, and you have to be able to voice your complaints. And I think this is every bit as true in our human relationships, right? We need space to be able to complain and to raise our concerns. But we do it, we hope, with a sense of responsibility, of thoughtfulness, that we and that we don't live and die complaining. That complaining is the first step. So anyway, that's the first discipline of humanness, of what Brueggemann calls the first discipline of humanness in extremis, humans in an extreme situation. And so so there's the first discipline of humans in hard situations. The second is petition. And petition is the second feature of discipline in crisis. And it gives, in some sense, legitimacy to the complaint by not merely stopping at a complaint, which would be nothing, I think, more than just simply selfish catharsis. Petition takes seriously the trouble that gave rise to the complaint in the first place. And it attempts to persuade God to take responsibility for righting the wrong. And again, I think of the protesters. If they were simply yelling and screaming, but there was no substance to their complaint, there was no petition to it, it was simply yelling and screaming for the sake of yelling and screaming, that would be not only ineffectual, but it would be that form of selfish, baseless complaining, right? That's presumptuous, that doesn't do anything. But what Brueggemann is arguing is that following that honest complaint is this sense of is an actual petition. We're not only yelling and screaming, but we're also saying, "But this is what we want. This is what should happen. This is what we're demanding, and this is what we need. And again, we see this all over the Psalms. And this is done, this petitioning, in a register of both faith and hope, right? You wouldn't petition someone you didn't think was listening. You wouldn't petition someone you didn't think, that you thought didn't care. We by complaining, we recognize that there is another entity involved in this exchange, and by petitioning to them, we recognize that we are making a reasonable request to a reasonable party. I think again of the prodigal son. The boy never would have thought to confess to his father if he didn't assume his father was fair. If his father had been a tyrant, it never would have occurred to the boy to confess to the father, to go back home from whence he came. It occurred to him that his father is deeply fair, that the father treats his own slaves fairly, and that the son, the sort of erstwhile son, he's no longer a son, even if he were treated as a slave, would be treated fairly. So we entreat, we petition a God who we believe is fair, and that's why it is done in this register of faith and hope. We wouldn't address the petition to God if we didn't think he could do something about it, or wouldn't do something about it if we didn't believe he was competent and just. And in this sense, of course, Yahweh still retains the power because we are petitioning him. But he isn't simply deferred to at every juncture. We are, after all, called to be in relationship to him, not merely blind subservience, as I've said. And you see this in Robert Duvall's The Apostle, that wonderful movie where his character rants and rages against God, but always in a spirit of petition. Lord, I'm not just complaining because I want to complain. I'm complaining because this is what I want done. I need your help. I need this changed. And that, again, plays out in our human relationships, right? That it's not enough to merely complain. But we need to then suggest, demand, ask for a different course of actions. I remember learning the kind of the hard way when I started working in business that it wasn't enough to point out what was going wrong, that I would not be, I wouldn't have a very long audience with the CEO of the company if all I did was come in there and complain about what wasn't working right. I was warned, don't waste Bill's time pointing out what's wrong. If you have the temerity to go in there and point out what's wrong, you better have the wisdom to suggest what might be right. You better have a petition ready to go. And I think, this is true when in human relationships with family and with people we love, with children and spouses, that it's one thing to complain and necessary even to do so as a responsible act of redressing grievances. But then we need to have a petition. And so that's the second discipline of humanness when we are in difficult situations is petition. And then the third and final feature of this set of disciplines is thanksgiving, which comes as God responds to our needs and troubles. And he will, as C.C. Winans' song that I played in the last class indicates, as Reverend Al Sharpton's eulogy for George Floyd indicates, that God will respond to our need and trouble, that he is in the business of restoration and redemption, however that might look, even though it may involve 40 years in the wilderness or walking through the valley of the shadow of death. God is all about restoration and redemption. And sometimes that restoration and redemption hurts. Sometimes it involves tragic consequences. But thanksgiving always follows from complaint and petition, and thus it completes this third discipline, completes the cycle of what it means to be fully human in crisis. And I'm quoting Brueggemann again, this sequence of complaint, petition, thanksgiving, which is the characteristic plot line of Israel's complaint psalms, is a primary datum for Israel's discernment of human personhood. End quote.
This is what it means to be fully alive, Brueggemann is saying, that we have three disciplines of human personhood that we want to practice in normal circumstances. So listening, discerning, and trusting. And the first three, though, are not adequate to the task of what it means to be truly living when things are not going as we had planned, when everything breaks down. Then there's another set of three disciplines when things fall apart, when we are sort of in extremis, is the term he uses, and that is of complaint, petition, and gratitude. And that this sequence, these two sets of disciplines, set out a pattern for what it means to be fully alive and responsive to God's will. So effectively, it's the substance of what the Old Testament is telling us about what it means to be fully human. And so we come full circle to the question about our fundamental identity as Christians,
as followers of God, the God of Abraham and of Isaac and of Jacob, of Jesus Christ, that what it means, and this goes back now 2 or 3 weeks, to needing to, I was saying there a few weeks ago, that we need to understand our identity as people before we understand where God might be calling us in Exodus, where we are in exile. As we talk about our origin stories in Genesis, part of that origin story is a loss of innocence. It's a rebellion and betrayal, and now we have to recover, and we have to be redeemed, and that cycle of gift, loss, redemption, of life, death, and new life, that this is our fundamental identity as Christians, so that when we encounter difficult seasons in our lives that may last a week, a month, a year, 2 years, 10 years, that we recognize at the end of the day that that's fundamentally what it means to be alive, is that there are times when we will struggle, and some of us are called to struggle more than others, but ultimately we are not our own, but we're made for relationship to God and to each other, right? That is our fundamental identity, that no man or woman is an island. We are all part of the main. And when one of us suffers, we all suffer. The bell tolls for thee and for me. And when one person is freed, we are all freed. When one of us dies, a part of each of us dies. And this is what it means to be a Christian in the midst of a global pandemic, of what now is being called the dual pandemic of the coronavirus and the pathogen of racism. That the reason we march, the reason we care, the reason we speak up is because we are all in this together, black, white, brown, that we are all part of the main, we're all part of humanity, and that, as Frederick Buechner says, how can any of us be at peace at home until all of us are at peace and at home? We weren't called to a life of contentment. I think that's one of the big misnomers of contemporary Christianity, is that somehow God just wants us to be content. Well, maybe content in terms of what we have, each of us, enough is a good word to use, right? We have enough. We don't need more. We have enough. But not content for the world, because so much of the world is suffering. But here's the grand irony. In defining ourselves in relationship to God and to each other, we become not less but more ourselves, more independent in our interdependence, because we're now living according to how we were created, right? So that finally, who we are most intimately in the depths of our being, in the imago Dei, is the very thing we share most commonly with other people. And that becomes the grand irony of the theological anthropology class I teach, my students. We've talked about it in this class, that what goes deepest in each one of us is shared most widely with all of us. What is most personal to me is most universal to everyone. Which means, controversially, that you don't need to be a woman to understand a woman's plight. just like you don't need to be a man to understand a man's plight. Now, I understand and I believe that to fully understand it as deeply as a woman might, the plight of women in a largely male-dominated society, it probably is necessary to be a woman. But I can understand a woman's plight just like she can understand mine, because we're both human beings, right? This is why you have black, white, and brown people all marching together for the civil rights, really, again, of the African-American person in the United States. You do need to be a black person to fully understand the plight of black America, but you don't need to be a black person to get some sense of what it means, what injustice looks like, what racism feels like. And I reject the idea among my more liberal friends that you have to be a certain type of person to experience what they're experiencing, because what that says is that they're so different from me that we have nothing in common. But I don't buy that. I think that is equally destructive. I think it's a reverse form of racism. I'm not again suggesting that I understand completely what it means to be a black in the United States of America, or that I understand what it means to be a woman in a largely paternalistic culture. But I have some sense of it because I'm a human being. And on some profound level, we're all in this together. And I really do believe, and I don't just think it sounds nice, I think it's absolutely fundamentally true, that what we hold in common, it runs so much more deeply than what distinguishes us from each other. And so that allows us then to enter in to the pain of another person, or enter into the pain of another part of culture, because we understand what it means to be a human being. And I think that is such a crucial thing to point out, because we cannot claim for ourselves the totality of human experience and then deny that totality in other people, right? That again, no one can fully understand what it's like to be me and what I've gone through, but I'm married to a woman who understands me better than just about anyone. And she really has learned over the years to discipline herself to really hear me and hear who I am and what I'm about. And she really can enter into my world. That's really possible, in just the same way that we can enter into each other's worlds and feel each other's pain and march for each other's justice and even die for the cause of the other. That's the whole point, right? And that's what we're reminded of, is that we are in this together, that ultimately this is what binds us together. And I think about this even as a country. We are the United States of America, but too often we act, even in our protest, as the divided states of America. And I just, I find that equally reprehensible. There's that blatant form of racism that sees other people as less because of this color of their skin. But there's a more subtle form of racism that sees the person as wholly other because of the color of their skin. So I think both of those things need to be addressed as we talk about what it means to be a country living together under the same cosmic roof, and what it means to be a common humanity, right? I mean, I think this is why people can march for the life of the innocent child, right? That none of us remembers what it was like to be in our mother's womb, but we all recognize our common humanity, and that we can march for the life of those people who cannot yet speak, who cannot yet form a thought, but they're every bit as human as we are, that we can do that because we understand what it means to be a human being, that all of us do. And I think this is what also allows us to hold people like Donald Trump accountable for policies and that he's promoting, and the hatred and the division that he is sowing, we can hold him accountable because he's a human being too, and he ought to know better than to say what he's saying. If we demonize someone like Donald Trump, we let him off the hook. Well, but because after all, what do demons do? But if we understand him to be one of us, he's part of the human family, and those who disagree with us are part of the human family, then we begin to see things in a totally different light. And that takes a tremendous amount of discipline and restraint and self-control and generosity. And so for every, as cathartic as it might feel for us to complain against the presidency and policies of Donald Trump, at the very same time, we need to be praying for him, praying for his judgment and his soul and his heart. If we want to be consistent in our approach to what it means to be thoughtful people. And I thought about this, what would this look like to really live into this new reality where we define ourselves fundamentally and primarily in relationship to each other as part of a larger body, a collective identity of not only people, but of fellow believers, companion pilgrims on this narrow and treacherous road of redemption. Well, I think it would look heroic. I think it would look like what we see, like what happened. I think it was in Massachusetts, or maybe it was in Maine, where a white police officer was responding to the distress of another police officer, and he was all alone walking through a crowd of very angry protesters. And a young black man saw that this policeman was just trying to help out his buddy. And so that young man stood in between the police officer and the rioting crowd. And then another man joined him, another black man, and then a third. And pretty soon there were seven or eight of them locking arms, forming a barrier between that policeman and the rioters. And they did that because they understand our common humanity. You don't need to be a white policeman to understand what a white policeman is going through. And this is, I'm referring to those policemen who are among the many who are good and who put their lives on the line for our sake. I think this idea that the entire police force is full of corrupt policemen is just an absolutely bankrupt idea. I mean, the policies may need to change and the way that we police in this country may need to change, but good golly, I know that there are a lot of good policemen out there just trying to do the right thing. And so that black man's move to stand in the midst, to stand in the breach, so to speak, was really heroic. And I was thinking about this Alfred Lord Tennyson's poem, Ulysses. And this is how, these are the closing lines of that terrific poem. Come, my friends, 'tis not too late to seek a newer world. Push off, and sitting well in order, smite the sounding furrows. For my purpose holds to sail beyond the sunset and the baths of all the western stars until I die. It may be that the gulfs will wash us down. It may be we shall touch the happy isles and see the great Achilles whom we knew. Though much is taken, much abides. And though we are not now that strength which in old days moved earth and heaven, that which we are one equal temper of heroic hearts, made weak by time and fate, but strong in will to strive, to seek, to find, and not to yield. So just to wrap this part up of Brueggemann's, what he calls the covenantal existence as alternative humanness. Like here's an alternate vision of what it means to be a human being. We read about how the human person in well-being and equilibrium is a person who is obedient and who discerns and who trusts. And it's that obedience versus autonomy, this autonomy that denies accountable relatedness, that we are accountable to each other because we can relate with each other. That's the sort of obedience we're called into. And then discernment versus the technique that denies a fabric of order in creation, that there is a discernment here that we see we're all part of the main, that we're all created in God's image, and that what binds us together is deeper than what sets us apart. And that finally, human trust, that third discipline in that first order of human disciplines, of human trust versus anxiety. We can't allow ourselves to succumb to the anxiety of postmodern life. That we have to trust that there is a plan. And then finally, the second set of disciplines of the human person in extremis, where it's complaint versus docility, it's petition versus resignation, and then it's thanksgiving versus self-sufficiency. That we are to finally to be grateful to God for who he is, so that we move from God as provider to God as provision. And this take is what we see eventually happening with the Israelites in Exodus. And this outline represents Brueggemann's, using that as sort of the foundation for our outline. It represents what I think is a crucial response and rejoinder to the nihilism that pervades contemporary notions of what it means to be human. And the nihilism that pervades contemporary culture, right? And I want to end with these two quotes from Brueggemann. The first goes like this: because the struggle for humanness is crucial in the world of late capitalism, that's his term, and because much theological conflict is now extrapolated into conflict over humanness, we may pause to consider the ways in which this construct of human personhood, which eschews all essentialism and which stakes humanness on relatedness, contrasts with the predominant temptations of our self-destructive culture. That first quote Brueggemann is saying is, look, when we define ourselves as entities unto ourselves, that we hold, there's more about us that's different than what we have in common. That is a self-destructive culture, because we are defining ourselves as an island. But what we're doing, what Brueggemann is contending, is that we eschew, we get rid of, we deny all essentialism. Essentialism is a movement in philosophy that says we are all essences unto ourselves. And alternatively, stakes our humanness on our relatedness to each other. And if we do that, we are living witnesses to standing against the predominant temptations of this sort of what's the right word I'm looking for here? Insular understanding of who we are, whether as a person or as a culture. So that's the first quote. And then this last quote: there is no doubt that Yahweh relates to human creatures as free and sovereign. In other words, Yahweh is free and sovereign, and that's how he relates to us. These creatures are created out of Yahweh's great generosity and perhaps out of Yahweh's yearning. They are situated in the midst of Yahweh's sovereignty and commanded to live on Yahweh's terms. When those terms are violated, trouble comes. The world of human persons in their life with Yahweh is a fairly tight moral system. The amazing thing is that in the midst of the sanctions that Yahweh pronounces, in the face of guilt and in the face of mortality, in the face of both situations in which the human person is helpless, Yahweh is attentive. Full of steadfast love and compassion, Yahweh is like a father who pities, like a mother who attends. Yahweh is indeed for human persons, for them while they are in the pit, willing and empowering them to newness. It is the central conviction of Israel that the human person in the pit may turn to this one who is powerfully sovereign and find that sovereign one passionately attentive. That is the hope of humanity, and in the end, its joy. And I think that's probably a fitting place for us to end too, that God is passionately attentive to us right now. He is hearing us, and he is responding and will respond, and we just have to believe that. Okay. That's it for now. We'll pick it up again next week.